From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, designing the future of cyberspace. Computer and communications technology may soon connect us via an information highway that would carry video, voice, and data, changing everything from entertainment to education, commerce, and research. We'll talk with Mitch Kapor, the founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He also founded the Lotus Software Company. Also, we talk with writer-director Rob Weiss, whose first film, Among Friends, was a hit at this year's Sundance Film Festival. It's about young men from the affluent suburbs of Long Island who turn to crime. And David Bianculli reviews the Nutella movie, Chantilly Lace. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. FBI officials in Los Angeles called a news conference this afternoon to say that they've arrested eight alleged white supremacists. The eight are charged in connection with what the FBI says was a plot to bomb a prominent black church and kill Rodney King, the man whose videotaped beating by police helped touch off last year's riots. NPR's Renee Montaigne reports.
The U.S. Attorney's Office says those arrested included four men, two women, and two juveniles, and that all are members of either the White Aryan Resistance or the Church of the Creator, both white supremacist groups. Seven of the suspects were arrested on weapons charges. An eighth man was booked on charges involving conspiracy to manufacture pipe bombs and obtain weapons in order, say federal officials, to destroy the, quote, parish and parishioners of the First African Methodist Episcopal Church, which played a prominent role during and after L.A.'s riots last year. The arrest came in a massive sweep of four Southern California counties and was the result, say federal authorities, of a year-and-a-half-long investigation involving agents who infiltrated the white supremacist groups. In Los Angeles, I'm Renee Montaigne.
The Pentagon said today that it will provide 30 warplanes to the NATO force protecting so-called safe havens for the Muslims in Bosnia. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization agreed yesterday that U.S., French, and Dutch warplanes could start the protection operation as early as July 22nd. The operation is expected to involve about 60 planes flying from bases in Italy. While the rivers that run through Des Moines, Iowa, are starting to recede, Des Moines mayor has signed a proclamation banning people from going to work in downtown office buildings. Mark Moran of member station WOI reports.
This city of a quarter million people may have running water by Monday. Though it won't be drinkable, it will be water the city can use for emergency sprinkler systems. Today, Des Moines Mayor Pat Dorian declared all downtown office buildings unsafe. Some people have been going to work in those buildings, but Dorian says the measure will be enforced by police if the need be to protect the people's safety and sanitation.
We're not going to tolerate it. We cannot. We do not have sprinkler systems in the building, do not have sanitation facilities in the buildings. The people's health is at risk on two different fronts.
The ominous Raccoon River, which overtook the Des Moines Waterworks plant Sunday morning, is now receding. But weather experts forecast heavy rainstorms this weekend, and the sigh of relief this town seems to be breathing may be over. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Moran in Des Moines.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 8 points to close at 3,551. Declining issues led advances by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR News. During his visit to Capitol Hill today, President Clinton consulted with lawmakers from Midwestern states stricken by floods. He said the administration is working closely with local officials to keep up with damage estimates. The director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency says that the cost for flood relief will probably exceed $8 billion. 10 of the defendants in the alleged plot to blow up several sites in New York City pleaded not guilty today. They included the latest suspect, 42-year-old Ibrahim El-Gibrani, who was indicted yesterday. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
The 10 men appeared together before federal judge Michael Mukasey in Manhattan. During the hearing, Mukasey gave prosecutors 3 weeks to turn over more than 150 hours of tapes that will be used as evidence in the trial. They include tapes that prosecutors say were recorded for national security purposes. They did not say who made these tapes, but the FBI is known to have conducted regular surveillance of extremist Muslim groups in this country. They also include recorded conversations between the defendants and Imad Salim, the government informant who infiltrated the group. According to papers filed at El Gibrani's indictment yesterday, Salim was feeding information to authorities back in late 1991. Prosecutors say the 11 suspects were part of a wide-ranging conspiracy to blow up two underwater tunnels, United Nations headquarters, and the federal building housing the FBI. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
Three of United Airlines' major unions said today that they'll offer wage and benefits cuts in exchange for a part ownership in the airline. The union coalition is composed of the airline's pilots, machinists, and flight attendants. United had asked for worker concessions earlier this year. The flight attendants and machinists refuse, and the pilots have been studying the airline's books. The deal follows a similar one that was worked out last week between Northwest Airlines and its unions. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. America is on the verge of creating a new interstate highway system. It's not about roads, and it's not about cars. It's a computerized, cable-connected information highway that will carry video images, sound, and data. It has the potential to change entertainment, shopping, education, research, and long-distance communication. There are lots of important questions to be answered about who will own it and who will make the rules, who will have access. My guest, Mitch Kapor, is one of the people working to ensure that the information highway will be as widely accessible as possible with few limitations on content. Kapor co-founded the Electronic Frontier Foundation, dedicated to realizing the democratic potential of new computer and communications media. He also founded the software company Lotus Development Corporation and designed its most popular program, Lotus 123. I asked him to explain the information highway.
The cable and telephone companies are in the process of rewiring their networks to be able to deliver not only existing voice and one-way television, but interactive voice, data, and video. As much of it as you want, hundreds or thousands of channels. And that whole system is a kind of an information highway system. And there will be major arteries that run across the country that could be thought of as the superhighways. And then there will be a series of on-ramps and off-ramps and driveways, and that will be the pieces of the network that will actually run into the homes.
Give us, like, the rosy scenario version of what the information highway could do for us and what we could do with it.
Well, if you want to look to the upside, these networks are likely to become the major conduits for not only entertainment, but also commerce and education, and will provide a plethora of new services, and will actually form a new communications medium that will be very open, will support a diversity of points of view and many different voices and shades of opinion. It will be used to stimulate a new kind of political discourse. It will bring people who are socially isolated together into virtual communities. Oh, and by the way, you'll be able to get every single Arnold Schwarzenegger movie ever made at any time of day or night.
Oh, because you don't have to go to the store to rent a movie and they only have 4 copies.
By punching some particular buttons on your remote control, you'll be able to select the particular movie out of thousands of movies whenever you want it.
Okay, so in the best case scenario, we can select whatever movies we want. We could shop through this. We could probably vote through it. We could talk to each other. What about the pessimist scenario about what happens if it's not done right?
Well, the pessimistic scenario is really that the uses will be very narrow and limited to something like the delivery of entertainment and maybe interactive shopping. Pessimistically, it will be some small group of very large corporations which will determine the content and the uses and not the users. It will be closed rather than open. It will be limited to a very narrowly defined set of purposes that will serve commercial interests, and it will really fail to serve larger social interests. And oh, by the way, it will create a further gap between the information haves and the have-nots.
Yeah, I guess in the pessimist scenario, you get the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie anytime you want it, and you can't get much else.
That's right. Well,
you can't get the independent filmmaker.
Right. You'll be able to get the Hair Club for Men network also.
Right. Now, the models that we have for thinking about interconnection in America are the public utilities, the phone company, cable TV. How might the information highway compare to those models?
Well, the big question, there are a couple of big questions about the nature of the network. One of the key issues is whether the network is going to be divided up into channels the way cable television is, or whether it's going to be more like the existing phone network in which anybody can talk to anybody else. Hence, the total number of simultaneous programs or conversations is, you know, extraordinarily large. In a channelized system, even one of 500 channels, there's going to be a real limitation on who can say what. And that is not going to promote diversity. So the existing telephone network of the models that you cited is a pretty good one because it does support point-to-point communication. Anybody can say anything. And it also operates under what's called a common carrier regime, which basically means that the network owner and operator doesn't have the ability to control the content or discriminate. If you want to get on the network, you can get on. If you want a phone, you can get a phone, and you can say what you want to say. And so that type of architecture and that type of policy seems to make the most sense.
So you want the most open system possible in terms of the two-way communication possibilities.
That's right.
Of the information highway. Now, what are we talking about? Are we talking about a system that uses computers and cable TV so that we can watch, we can speak, we can type? What's all the hardware that would be connected through this information highway?
Well, right now, people are frantically trying to sort this out. There will be a much smarter version of the cable converter box that sits on top of the TV. That will be one of the principal ways that this network will enter the home. It will really be a very powerful computer, hopefully one with a nice, simple user interface that you can control with your remote control. And that is how you will do your information surfing and select your video programming and do your interactive shopping. I also think that there will be another feed will come off that wire and will go into either a personal computer or a descendant of today's personal computers. That will be a much smaller unit with a screen. It will probably have either some sort of a keyboard or a mouse or something like that. And you will do your informational types of activities, your messaging and maybe even your video conferencing that way.
Who is fighting behind the scenes now to see who will control the information highway?
Well, there's been an extraordinary upsurge in business activity in the cable industry and, to a lesser extent, among the local telephone companies to form alliances, to build experimental networks of the future, to get involved in agreements with computer companies. The private sector really has the bit in its teeth at this point because it's become an article of faith that movies on demand and interactive shopping are going to make them a lot of money. So there's just been an enormous momentum in that arena. You know, we haven't said anything about another very important area of development, which is that there is something called the Internet, which is, it's seemingly a wholly separate development. And the Internet is a network of computer networks that grew up out of the research community and served sort of universities, which has now expanded very dramatically to begin to serve businesses and the general public. And there are some millions of people connected to each other through the internet, not only in the U.S. but around the world, who use it every day as a medium for communication with electronic mail and transferring files of information back and forth, and even beginning to do some multimedia. In fact, there are more people on the internet, which is this very highly decentralized, very open system, than any other information infrastructure. And the internet, in a lot of ways, exemplifies the kind of values of openness that we were talking about. And one thing that nobody has really asked, and it's certainly not understood, is what is the future of that internet? Is it going to remain its own thing? Is it going to be taken over by cable? Is it going to merge into it? It's not clear.
What do you think we should learn from the success of internet and try to apply to the information highway?
Well, I think there are a number of very important lessons. Some people call the internet the world's largest functioning anarchy. It is a case in point that you do not need to have a very tightly and centrally controlled authority running a large network, that we know enough in the digital era about how to do things in a way that does not enforce that type of rigidity. And when you do have that type of open system, you get a lot of innovation. You get people trying out all sorts of new services and new ideas. It's a very fertile ground for innovation. And therefore, you can get very rapid development of user populations, and you get all sorts of interesting new phenomena emerging. When the internet first started, the whole idea was to let the computer scientists at MIT, when they came in the morning, get access to computers on the West Coast that were underutilized because it was 6 in the morning. Instead, it turned out that what people did was electronic mail. They wanted to exchange messages. They wanted to communicate with each other. More recently, we've seen the emergence of what some people are calling virtual communities or wide area communities. These are groups of people that are held together not by their geographic proximity, but because they hold some interest in common. But they really function like a real community with insides and outsides and norms and values and strong feelings and shared experiences. And I think the internet teaches us that networks can be a way that people can get closer to one another. And so it's a very serendipitous and positive example of uses of technology.
Who runs the internet? Is there anybody who owns it or runs it or creates the rules on it?
Well, it is a collection of distinct networks, each of which is administered by somebody. It may be a university. It may be a private entity that sells connections to businesses that wish to be on it. And all of these intermediate networks are interconnected with one another, really not through any formal authority, but because all of those parties have agreed to do that through a series of arrangements. So it's a collective organism. It's not a single entity.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Mitch Kaper, a co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and he was also the founder of Lotus Software Company, and he designed their most popular program, Lotus 123, a spreadsheet program. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Mitch Kaper. He's the co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He also founded Lotus Software Company, and he designed their most popular software, Lotus 123. And we're talking about the information highway. There's so many issues involved with how the information highway could be created, and yet so many Americans aren't even computer literate at all, let alone able to comprehend all the issues involved with this, which I think mitigates against this being a very, very democratic system. In other words, in terms of input, in terms of everyone in America contributing some kind of input to the design of the system.
Well, I agree with you that there is a big understanding gap, and that this all seems very abstract to most people and perhaps more than a bit frightening. And sometimes people who are involved in this as a business like to keep it that way because it makes it their little secret. I mean, I really think now is the time to have the public discussion on all of these issues before critical decisions are made, before we wake up to the creation of another vast wasteland in one of the pessimistic scenarios. And when Newton Minow said that, I think it was, you know, around 1960, it was already too late by at least a decade, if not more, to do anything about television. The great thing is we still have some time now because the fundamental decisions have not been made irrevocably, and therefore those citizens who have an interest in participation. And of course, democracy is voluntary. You're not required to vote. You have the option to vote. This is a good time to get involved and to learn more about what's going on and to ask the difficult questions.
Now, you started your group, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, after the FBI came looking for you, not because of something you did wrong, but because of information they wanted from you to help track down somebody else. Would you tell us the story?
Well, it's peculiar because I had not had any contact with our law enforcement agencies. At one point, somebody sent me anonymously a diskette, computer diskette, with what purported to be the source code or instructions making up part of the operating system for the Macintosh computer, the heart, soul, and brains of the Macintosh, something that Apple guards very fiercely. I looked at it, realized it wasn't mine, and contacted Apple and sent it back to them for them to do with what they want. 6 months go by, and I've put the matter out of my mind completely. I get a call. The FBI wants to come and talk to me about this because they are trying to find the people who did this. And so two agents showed up, and I wound up having a very long and painful conversation with them because it was evident that while they were set with this task of tracking this down, they had not a clue about computers or source code or operating systems, and they didn't know, you know, a computer chip from a cow chip. Not their fault. They weren't trained for it, but they were being asked to do this. And it was a very disturbing experience because I could see that no good was likely to come out of it. I filed that experience away in my mind. But a couple of months later, a friend and colleague of mine, whom I had met online in a computer conferencing system called The Well, had a similar experience. They came and talked to him. This is a guy named John Perry Barlow, former cattle rancher, lyricist for the Grateful Dead, and all-around troublemaker. And he was moved to write something about the bizarreness of his experience of talking to the FBI. It struck a bell with me. I mean, it really resonated. And we got to talking about this, and we realized that there was this terrible disconnection between the sort of avant-garde of technology users who were online, using bulletin boards, communicating, logging onto computers through the internet, and the rest of the world, including the law enforcement agencies, and that there were conflicts and that there were misapprehensions and mistakes. And in particular, we saw that there was a whole class of innocent people that were in the process of getting chewed up by the law enforcement system. The Secret Service was after hackers. There are a lot of kids running around, breaking into computers, stealing computer cycles, making free telephone calls, and doing things that they shouldn't be doing. But in the process of going after them, they were being demonized. They were being made into the new red menace. And not only that, other people, completely innocent parties, people who were operating computer bulletin boards, businesses just to talk to their customers, were getting their computer equipment seized. So we felt we had to do something. And that's the genesis of the EFF. Now, our conception of what had to be done has grown a great deal. At first, we thought what we needed to do was to ensure that the civil liberties of computer and network users weren't being violated. And we thought we would need to do that in court. And in fact, we've had one court case that concluded recently in a very favorable fashion that arose out of the matters around which we were founded. But what we really discovered very quickly was that these conflicts between cops and hackers were symptomatic of a broader set of issues of society trying to adapt to and digest all of this new technology. And we said, what we think will help is if we create an organization that can try to educate people, try to broaden awareness, one that has a very strong commitment to civil liberties and the productive and beneficial uses of this technology. And that's where EFF came from.
Now, it's interesting to me that you got into this because the FBI was tracking you down for information that would lead them to computer pirates, people who had tried to disseminate the Apple computer secrets. Mm-hmm. Now, you were the founder of Lotus Software. And in fact, the program you created, Lotus 123, that has the reputation as being the most pirated software in history so far. So I imagine on some level you were probably very sympathetic to wanting to crack down on the computer pirates.
Well, my sympathies are probably as much with the users of computers as they are with the people who make the software. And clearly, people who make the software are entitled to a fair return on their efforts. And when piracy is committed on a conscious basis or on a basis where there is a profit motive, I mean, clearly that's highly illegal and ought to be. But we have problems in the society making appropriate distinctions between a kind of piracy for profit and somebody... a kid who is fooling around and makes a copy of a program and uses it, who wouldn't buy it to begin with, and is experimenting. I'm not condoning the behavior, but I am saying we need a lot more proportionality in how we think of that, and we need to make sure that the punishment fits the crime. And it seems to me that sometimes the holders of the intellectual property rights take an attitude of lock them up and throw away the key, which is overbroad and quite inappropriate. So it is not a black and white situation. The copyright owners need to be protected, but at the same time, if they go about it in a heavy-handed way, which unfortunately happens quite a lot, then the users need protection. We really have to rethink a lot of notions about property and business in the digital era, because software is just different than tangible things like lawnmowers and forks.
Why did you get out of the software business? And are you still creating programs even though you're not marketing them?
I stepped aside from Lotus in 1986 fundamentally because I don't like big companies, even ones that I started. I'm more interested in creating products than running a business, and I just found it personally burdensome. Some people enjoy the presence of command and the ability to sort of move large armies of employees and make headlines and cause things to happen, and I just found myself having more and more sleepless nights worrying about all the responsibility. So I was happy to step aside, as it was not my ambition to create and run a $250 million a year company, which is the size that it was then. I haven't been actively designing software, but I have quite a few notebooks filled with ideas, and at some point in the next few years, I'm likely to turn my hand in some fashion to making some of them into products.
Mitch Kapor, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Mitch Kapor is the co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Putting up money for an independent movie can be a real gamble. Rob Weiss got $20,000 for his first feature from some real gamblers. We'll talk with Weiss about the making of Among Friends, which was a hit at this year's Sundance Film Festival. It's about young men from affluent suburbs who become criminals. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the new Showtime telemovie, Chantilly Lace. It stars seven well-known actresses, including Jill Eikenberry, Talia Shire, and Ellie Sheedy, who improvise their way through a loosely framed dramatic plot. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. U.S. officials have announced that 40 airplanes will be sent to Europe to help protect so-called safe havens in Bosnia. This comes after agreement by NATO nations that planes from the United States, France, Britain, and the Netherlands will start protecting U.N. ground forces in Bosnia as early as next week. NATO planes have been policing a no-fly zone set by the U.N. to keep Serbian planes from flying over Bosnia. The White House says that President Clinton may not accept Secretary of Defense Les Aspin's recommendation for easing the ban on gays in the military. Today was the deadline for Aspin's proposal to be sent to the White House. NPR's Martha Raddatz reports.
Aspin has been laboring over the proposal for months, trying to strike some sort of balance between the White House, Congress, gay activists, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It is the Don't Ask, Don't Tell proposal supported by the Joint Chiefs that Aspin, according to sources, discussed with President Clinton in a late-night meeting at the White House. After the meeting, Aspin returned to the Pentagon to work on the plan. White House spokeswoman Dee Dee Myers said the president had a couple of outstanding questions. He was interested in what the practical effects of the policy would be, said Myers. Myers said the president would look over Aspin's final proposal and would have some sort of announcement, possibly by tomorrow. The Pentagon said it expects to implement the new policy by October 1st. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
President Clinton today took a step toward delivering on a campaign promise. He had wanted 100 community development banks, but economic realities indicate a smaller program. Now, Mr. Clinton has announced legislation that would spend more than $380 million on community development banks over 4 years. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
The president called for the creation of a special fund for community development banks. Every dollar the fund provides must be matched by another dollar of private capital to bring basic banking services to poor areas. There is strong bipartisan support for the plan on the Hill, but there are critics. Republican Senator Al D'Amato says fewer than 200 existing financial institutions would be eligible, and big commercial banks would be shut out.
I am doubtful that establishing another government-run, taxpayers-funded program is the answer.
D'Amato says he likes the idea of the bill and will work to make it better. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
President Clinton heads back to the Middle West this weekend to take another look at flood damage there. Mr. Clinton will be in St. Louis Saturday to talk to governors of 8 Midwestern states hit hard by flooding. It's the president's third trip in recent weeks to the area. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 8 points to close at 3,550.93. This is NPR News. In Bosnia, Serbian factions eased a 2-week fuel blockade of Sarajevo, allowing operations to resume in both the hospital and the bakery. Some 75 tons of diesel fuel were allowed into the city from the airport. Doctors at the hospital had been performing operations using only natural light. The bakery resumed work after being closed for more than 2 weeks. However, most areas of the city are still without running water and power. The city has been under siege now for more than 1 year. A new study finds that one out of every $5 spent by the federal Medicaid program pays for illness related to substance abuse. Medicaid is the government health insurance program for the poor. NPR's Patricia Nayment reports.
Researchers at New York's Columbia University looked at alcohol, tobacco, and drug use. They reviewed medical literature and found 70 health problems that can be attributed to abuse of these substances. For example, more than half of all AIDS cases among infants are related to drug use of parents. 87% of lung cancers are due to tobacco, 72% of chronic pancreas disease due to alcohol, and over half of all strokes due to cigarettes or cocaine. Researchers who conducted the study call substance abuse America's public health enemy number one, adding that treatment for many other illnesses is made more difficult when patients also abuse drugs, alcohol, or cigarettes. Overall, the new study says substance abuse is responsible for more than $7.4 billion in Medicaid spending. I'm Patricia Nayment reporting.
The government says that business sales expanded 0.3% in May. The Commerce Department says that sales moved ahead of a growth in inventory, in a ratio that indicated it would take nearly 1.5 months to use up stockpiles of goods. Retail sales in May were up by 0.4%. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. One of the hits at this year's Sundance Film Festival was Amongst Friends. It's about three young men from the affluent suburbs of Long Island who turn to crime. The film was written and directed by the 26-year-old Rob Weiss, who already has a movie deal with Universal. In the film, the friends want to finance a drug deal. They need cash, so they hold up a nightclub owned by a local gangster. When the club owner finds out, his men round up the friends and haul them into the club to face the owner.
You shoot my regular security guy. And they got him hanging from the ceiling, ass up, in South Nassau. But that's not my problem. My problem is, you took my money.
It's not what you think.
Shut up! You keep your f***ing mouth shut. You're not that tough. You're all a bunch of f***ing pansies. I'll bet that you had never missed a meal in your f***ing life. When I was a kid, we stole because we had no money. You understand? We had no money. But in those days, we had respect.
Sir, I had no idea. This asshole I got high with, he told me it was nobody's place. I'm with people.
You're not with anyone!
Yes, I understand that. I'm not with anyone. But I'd never disrespect you, I swear. I swear I'd never disrespect you. And my friends here, they didn't have anything to do with it. I set the whole mess up myself. I'll take full responsibility.
Spinach! Kid, you just don't get it. Do you know who I am?
Yeah, you're the boss.
You ever hear of Jackie Trattner?
Jackie Trattner, yeah. I know him. He was my grandfather's best friend. He's dead now, right?
Kid, I might be tired, but I ain't dead.
The younger characters in your film are characters who don't steal because they're desperate and broke. Why do they steal?
Wow. Well, there's a lot of, you know, that's a lot of levels to that. You know, a lot of people have said it looks like it's out of boredom, things like that, but it's also to try to stake their own claim in the world. You know, it's like these are guys who will never gain a certain respect because they've been given a certain amount in their life. These are guys who want to go back to the basics of having nothing so that they can gain for themselves so they can earn that respect. I mean, that's the way I've always looked at it. I said they did that so that they can earn respect. You know what I mean? Most people have looked at it and said, well, you know, it's bored youth, this and that, and it is that to a degree as well. But I think it has a lot to do with respect.
These are people who want to act like they have nothing so that they can get respect for getting something. But they're already pretty middle class.
Right, exactly. You know, it's like these are not people who want to take advantage of the wealth or whatever it is, the privilege they've had, but want to get something for themselves. I mean, to them, it was much more glamorous to be like their grandfathers, which we say in the film, because their grandfathers and people came over on boats with no money, separated from their families, lived in basements, went and made something of themselves, something that they can sleep with as human beings at night. This is what these kids want. You know what I mean? These are kids who want to go out and be able to self-respect themselves. And through that, they do whatever it is they have to do, which makes them feel they'll get that.
Did you grow up in suburban Long Island?
Yeah, for the most part, I did.
And were you also trying to stake out an identity? Did you feel like you wanted to go back to your grandfather's sense of having made it himself?
I don't know if I'd ever consider. Well, yeah, I mean, to some degree, yes. You know, it's like you want to find your identity. I mean, I think everybody's looking for their identity. I'm still looking for mine. It's like, when do we know that? We don't know when we know that. I think I would have preferred. I wouldn't call myself privileged, you know what I mean? Like, I've had privileges. There have been times when I was more privileged than other times, but it was, you know, for the most part, I'd be up and down in a financial way, so I wouldn't look at it like privileged, like these kids. These kids are kids who are pretty much well off to, you know, pretty stable in that sense, whereas my upbringing was definitely somewhat different than that, but I experienced a lot of what they experienced in this film.
There's an interesting story behind how you financed the film. Would you tell us about it?
I mean, we didn't finance the whole film that way. It seems like it's getting out of hand a little bit.
We're getting exaggerated? Uh-huh. Okay.
Oh, it's getting so exaggerated. I mean, every article has a different, you know, it has a different approach to it. What happened was, when we first started the film, we had no cash. We were not looking to bring this film to anybody in the industry. We were looking to try to finance it, for the most part, by ourselves. So my dad was instrumental in getting some of his personal money and also getting some other people that he knew. He has a gambling business. What he is, he's a junket rep. So he sends trips, they're touring travel trips to Las Vegas or the islands. So he approached some of the clients and asked them to bet on the film as if they were betting on, like, let's say the Giants game or something like that. I mean, it wasn't really anything that financed the entire film, but it was instrumental in helping us begin production, getting through pre-production and production, until we, you know, had enough dailies that we can show to investors and industry people who would then finance it and let us complete the film in the manner that we wanted to work, the way we had been working on our own.
So were these heavy gamblers who he approached, or were these the kind of, like, weekend gamblers who want to, like, weekend getaway and go to Vegas for...
Right. Those mostly, you know, borderline. Weekend getaway guys, but also guys who might be a little crazy and fanatical about gambling. But most importantly, these were guys, the thing about this, these were guys who'd watched me grow up. These were people I knew as well. I mean, they were close friends of the family. For them to put up $2,500 on a film, which is what we were asking, seemed to be an awful lot. And then my dad's like, hey, you know, every single day you're betting $2,500 on something, it's like, then you could bet on somebody you've known for their entire life. You know, it's like, what is it? And he convinced them that way. And they looked at it like it was right. At least I was out there, you know, from his point of view, trying to do something that was good.
Let me ask you, the gamblers that your father knows, who you knew when you were growing up, any colorful characters among them?
Oh, they're all colorful characters, you know? I mean, my father's a colorful character, or a colorful guy, as I'd say. But, colorful how? I mean, they're hysterical guys. They're funny guys, you know? It's like that whole Vegas-y thing, you know? Big bracelets and necklaces. Funny guys. Very funny guys.
My guest is filmmaker Rob Weiss. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest Rob Weiss wrote and directed the new independent film Amongst Friends. Now, in the suburb that you grew up, was it considered that most people would be on a fast track to college and professional career?
Right. Well, that's interesting, because I grew up in Baldwin first, which is 20 minutes away from Five Towns or something. And Baldwin is a much different town. I mean, it's much more of a working class town, you know. And then I moved to Woodmere, and Woodmere is that kind of place where, yes, you graduate high school, you go off to a college. You know, you come back, you move into the city, and you do whatever it is you're going to do with your life, you know? And I didn't go away to school at that point because I was going to go to Parsons in New York, so I was still living at home. And then I met up with all these other guys who were, A, not going to school, B, or not going away to school, or C, had never been to school. I mean, you know, it's sort of like meeting up with all the lunatics in the town who were stuck around. And those become your friends. You know, those are the guys you start hanging out with. And then you find out that, hey, this is where I belong the whole time anyway. I didn't belong at George Washington or Boston University, you know? So, yeah, for the most part, your question was, did these kids go away? Yes. They're groomed, you know, most of these kids for success. I mean, most of my childhood friends were groomed for that.
What about you? Were you groomed for that?
No, not at all. No, I was not groomed to be successful, you know what I mean? I've said it a million times, you know, I'm not quite sure if this is where I belong, you know? I keep feeling like I should be, like, slinging dough somewhere or something, you know? I should be, like, picking up somebody's garbage in front of their house. That's not a self-esteem thing. That's just a matter of saying, no, you know, I didn't go away. I didn't get that kind of education. I don't fit into that area of the workforce, you know, the work population. It's like, no, I wasn't groomed for anything like that.
A lot of films about, you know, young people who end up becoming involved with crime, most of those films are set in urban areas.
Right.
They're usually working class or poor people that are the subject of the film, whereas your film is set in, you know, a prosperous suburb. Did you feel that the subject would be treated differently because of that different setting and because of the different background that the kids are from?
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, what we did is we looked at films before we started working on this, and we were like, hey, you know, you got Boys in the Hood, you have Matty Rich film Straight Out of Brooklyn, and what this was, we're like, this is wild, man, because these are Jewish kids doing exactly the same thing as those kids were, you know? So, I mean, that we looked at it like that, but I never really gave it much thought, like, inner city as opposed to suburbs and things like that, because, I mean, you're a fool or somebody's a fool if they don't believe crime can happen anywhere. You know, I mean, it's, you know, crime happens in the country, crime happens in the city, crime happens on sea, you know, I mean, it happens everywhere.
I was also wondering maybe if you'd seen, you know, recent films or earlier films, like some of Scorsese's films, and thought, well, how would this translate to my background? How would it translate to my neighborhood?
Yeah, I never looked at, I mean, I've seen every Scorsese film 50 times, but I never once looked at those for guidance in making my film. Mm-hmm. I never said, wow, I can make a suburban Mean Streets. You know, because the way I feel about that is, look, you open a magazine, oh, Nick Gomez, he made Mean Streets, you know. You look at Quentin Tarantino, he's rediscovering Mean Streets. Rob Weiss, Suburban Mean Streets. It's like, you cannot make a youth crime film in this country
right.
without it being compared to Mean Streets in some capacity. You know, I mean, it's just the way it is. And, hey, he beat everybody to the punch, and he's the most brilliant filmmaker who ever lived. But it's like, that is what it is. You know, I didn't look at that like that. The way Goodfellas, which we also get a lot of, you know, we get asked a lot about, was that, thing about Goodfellas is those guys are pretty basically the same, they come from the same mold as the guys in my film, or should I say the guys in my film come from the same mold as those guys, so that's why there are those similarities. Never did I look at Goodfellas and say, hey, I want to make a young Goodfellas or something like that, you know?
Another reason why I think the subject of Goodfellas would come up when talking about your film is that the female lead is the daughter of Paul Sorvino,
right.
One of the stars of Goodfellas.
Right.
How did
I mean, I was on the set of Goodfellas a half a dozen times because they were shooting in my neighborhood. I mean, it's a familiar setting. I mean, they talk about the five towns like a dozen times. You know, I mean, that's where the Lorraine Bracco character is from in the film. So it's like, I mean, there's a lot of similarities to it. You know, they talk about growing up by the airport. Hey, that's 5 minutes from where I grew up, you know? So it's like, that's a lot of that. But yes, Paul Sorvino's daughter is in the film, and she's a tremendous actress, so.
While we're on the subject of the Sorvino family, I think it's Paul Sorvino's father who plays the buddy of the the old crime guy.
Yeah, he plays Fish. Yeah, he's great, man. That guy's great.
Did you know that Paul Sorvino's father was an actor?
No, he's not. He had never acted before.
Oh.
He wasn't an actor. We made him an actor.
Oh,
we grabbed him and made him an actor. Because this is a guy with just so much natural charm and charisma that it's like, you know, it wasn't like he had to, like, build a character. He wasn't playing, you know, this one or that one or trying to do this or try to do that. He just came out and had to do what he had to do, you know, which was pretty much be true to himself in nature, you know. So he was just great as being himself. It was hysterical. That's who he is. He's hysterical.
You didn't have a lot of money to make the movie. What did you do to shoot cheaply on location?
Nothing. I mean, that was the thing, was that, I mean, of course, you know, we saved whoever we had to save. We'd run out of film a million times. I mean, we didn't have the amount of lights we would like to have had or be able to do the setups, all the setups that I wish we could have done, you know. But we set out to make a film that looked like a $7, $8 million film. And my film is a glossy-looking film. It's a beautifully shot film, a beautifully lit film. It's like the camera movements, like, you know, as smooth as they could be. It is pretty polished. It's like we set out to make that kind of film. So we never said, oh, we could shoot this in 16, or we could blow this up to 35, or let's shoot a black and white grainy. That wasn't the look we were going for. We did whatever we could do to save money, but we never worried about the money, because we always felt if we run out of money, we'll get more money. Yeah, I think my producer, Matt Blumberg, said this once, and he said it best, is that if we had $70,000, we never said, hey, how are we going to make this film for $70,000? We said, let's go shoot the film that we want to shoot with the $70,000. When we run out of money, then we'll worry about it. You know, we were on a mission, you know. It was unbelievable, so.
What did you use for location shots? Did you use friends' houses?
Well, we had latched up with some interior designer in the neighborhood who had turned us on to all his clients. You know, they were very supportive. I mean, there were people that came out of nowhere that helped us just so tremendously. You know what I mean? We'd go into his house, like the Gordon house or whatever it was in Cedarhurst, you know, and these are people who not only open their homes to us, but barbecue for us. You know what I mean? These were really, really supportive people who were just, I mean, I don't know what the word is to say, but they liked the energy that was around them. They liked the fact that this was a positive thing, kids doing a creative thing, as opposed to doing something negative. So they were very supportive. So we got those houses, and luckily, within most of these houses, there were things in those houses to use as props that were great. I mean, we had a great production designer, but if you're walking into a house and there's a $15,000 lamp that you could put in the, you know, the foreground of a scene, you're set. And we had a lot of that. You know, we shot in the right neighborhood, and the right people got behind us, so we were okay with that.
What's it like to cast a film when you're an unknown and you don't have much money?
You get no respect. I mean, that's all I could say. I mean, when you're an unknown with no money and you're trying to cast something, it's like, man, the stuff I went through. I hired actors who said, hey, you know, we'd hire an actor for a scene, then we'd have to change the date of when we're going to shoot it, and the guy would call back and say, I'm not doing it now. You know, I've done student films before, and I don't like the way I'm being treated. And it's like, pal, we're not doing a student film. We're just changing the date. So I'd be like, well, I'm not coming. It's like, all right, then don't show up. Now I know these people are rolling. They're miserable. You know what I mean? I get calls from these people who are like, oh, I never thought it would go like this. I can't believe this. This is unbelievable. So it's like, it's rough. You know what I mean? It's also very exciting. You know what I mean? Because there are none of these preconceived notions, you know? And you're finding actors who are the same thing as you, ripe. You know what I mean? Somebody who's just falling from this tree. So, I mean, there's both sides to that. You know what I mean? Being an independent filmmaker your first time out, no credibility, no money, no connections, it's rough. You know? But what do you have the opportunity to do? You have the opportunity to find people who believe in the same things you believe in, who are going for the same thing that you're going for, and who have the same heart that you have, and who are going to give themselves 150% to a project. You can't beat that, you know? So it's somewhere in the middle of that, you know? It's just the same way as how do you feel about going from doing an independent film to a studio now. It's like your problems just change hands, you know? It's like things I worried about with independent filmmaking I'm not going to have to worry about now at studios, but things I didn't worry about when I was making my first film I'm going to have to worry about now. So, I mean, you know, it's a give-and-take thing.
Rob Weiss, thank you very much for talking with us.
Hey, thanks for your time.
Rob Weiss wrote and directed the new film Amongst Friends. It opens in New York July 23rd and in other cities August 13th. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have on the flood?
Hi, Terry. Jackie Lydon reports on the Mississippi flooding from a treacherous situation at Quincy, Illinois. A levee is endangered there, and the bridge across the river would then be threatened. Robert Siegel joins us from Hannibal, Missouri. Mark Twain's town is protected, much of it, by a new flood wall. President Clinton announces a $382 million program to help the community banking program in this country, designed to make new money available in distressed economic areas. As a candidate, he was saying that he wanted to have a far more ambitious program. Also, new evidence to suggest that homosexuality may be based in biology. Scientists are studying the genetic makeup of gay men.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This month, the Showtime cable network is presenting an original telemovie called Chantilly Lace, which its creator and director, Linda Yellen, is calling an improvised production. TV critic David Bianculli explains and complains.
The idea here is to get a bunch of actresses together, give them the broadest framework of plot and characterization, and allow them to improvise their way through full-length dramatic scenes. The setting is a trio of reunions among longtime female friends. The stars are Jo Beth Williams, Lindsay Krause, Helen Slater, Jill Eikenberry, Martha Plimpton, Ally Sheedy, and Talia Shire. The results, edited together into a mostly coherent whole, are called Chantilly lace. Here's a typical scene, with Jo Beth Williams as Natalie and Helen Slater as Hannah. They're cutting vegetables in the kitchen and talking about Hannah's husband, who used to be Natalie's husband. Hannah is after advice, but Natalie can't offer much.
It's been really hard between us. He's not an easy guy. I just wish I had some way to, like, answer back to him, you know? I feel like I'm getting run over, and I need some caustic witticisms to kind of zing. I can't, like, get it out to him.
Yeah.
God, how do you do it?
I didn't do it, honey. If I'd done it, we'd still be together. Okay? And I warned you. I warned you, if you didn't know who the hell you were, that you would wind up like the incredible shrinking woman.
Chantilly lace might remind most viewers and critics of The Big Chill, but the movie I couldn't stop thinking about, believe it or not, was Jurassic Park. The problem is the gimmick. Showtime has gotten a lot of mileage out of letting everybody know that this film was basically made up as it went along. There have even been feature stories in national magazines explaining how the actresses drew pieces of paper from a hat the night before shooting the extended climax to learn which of their characters would die at the end. So when you sit down to watch Chantilly lace, you know you're watching what amounts to a very expensive acting class improv session. The job of the actresses, and of Chantilly lace, is to make you forget it. That's where Jurassic Park comes in. Everybody knows going in that Jurassic Park is a dinosaur movie loaded with special effects. Or, as David Letterman likes to sum it up in his two-word mantra, mechanical lizards. But the film does such a good job of bringing its fantasy world to life that you forget the mechanics and buy the illusion. With Chantilly lace, you don't. There's never a point where you don't see the seams, where you aren't conscious of the fact that these women are acting rather than inhabiting characters. I wonder whether, if the process of making this movie had been kept secret, it'd still seem as showy and disjointed. I suspect it would. Chantilly lace is worth watching, but not to find out what happens to these characters. It's worth a look to see what these actresses do with so much freedom. And, given the cast, who emerges as the most valuable and credible player. To me, that was the biggest and most pleasant surprise, because it's Helen Slater, who I might have picked to finish fourth or fifth out of this particular cast. With her economy and intelligence, Slater catches her co-stars, as well as the audience, off guard, and she's a real treat. The rest of Chantilly lace, though, is more of a novelty.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein and Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Coneheads movie opens next week. On the next Fresh Air, a Saturday Night Live retrospective featuring interviews from our archives with former cast members of the show. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.